Situational, depending on the level of the threat. Sophia narrowed her eyes.
I want it in writing, with the hazard bonus scale specified.
Done, Barabbas said. Dear gods, he'd made a small female version of himself. Sophia smiled.
Who will I be guarding? Me,
Martin said.
Hi, I'm Sophia.
Barabbas's daughter held out her hand. Martin shook it.
Hi, I'm Martin. What's in your bag? Nagaina.
Like father, like daughter.
What's a Nagaina?
Martin asked. Sophia slid her hand into the backpack and pulled out a cobra. Big and black, it wrapped around her arm and reared up, displaying a bright yellow chest. Martin froze.
Sophia, you're scaring the client, Barabbas said.
Don't worry, she's an Egyptian cobra. They're pretty docile and they don't spit venom.
Sophia smiled.
And they don't eat pine martens.
She slid the snake back into the bag. Are you sure about this? I asked Barabbas.
Quite. Sophia has a lot of experience despite her age, and Martin will be more comfortable with her.
This won't be a peaceful assignment. They will both be in danger.
And that's precisely why Sophia would be an excellent fit.
Barabbas smiled, a sharp, controlled baring of his teeth.
She can dedicate herself to this assignment completely. During the day, they will be here at the guild. During the night, they will be at our home. If problems arise, my husband and I will handle them. Additionally, we live in a unique community. I assure you, it's quite safe.
I bet. It's essential that nobody interrogates her about the murder, including Ascanio Ferrara. Sophia cracked her knuckles.
Oh, that won't be a problem.
Conlan clearly had something against Ascanio, and apparently Sophia wasn't a fan either. He sure had a way with children.
Does the pack have an interest in this case? Barabbas asked.
I don't know yet. However, Mr. Ferrara definitely does. Does that complicate things?
Not at all, Barabbas said. We do not fall under the pack's authority.
Like everyone who left the pack with Curran and Kate, Barabbas enjoyed a special status, and I counted on it.
Great. Here's her clothes and toiletries.
I passed the bag to Barabbas. The fee should cover her food, but please make sure she eats something besides cookies. Barabbas nodded.
Of course.
Do you like honey muffins?
Sophia asked Martin. I loved honey muffins. Curran's adoptive mother made them. I would kill for one of Martha's honey muffins right now. I would eat it and cry right here in the office. Martin's eyes lit up.
Are they yummy?
Very yummy.
Then I like them.
I have some in my office. Sophia held out her hand. Martin jumped off her chair, winked at me, and took Sophia's hand. They walked out of the office. That wink spelled trouble.
She is very good at escaping, I said. Sophia is very good at preventing escapes. I promise you, Ms. Ryder, she will be treated well. She will be bathed, fed, and tucked into bed at night, and most of all, she will be under constant supervision.
I had a nagging feeling he would eat those words, but there was nothing else I could do. I had given all the warnings I could give. I hired them to do a job, and I had to let them do it. 8. The phone line was nowhere near Martha Street. I figured on about a 50-50 chance of Stella sending me on a wild goose chase. Clearly, she either didn't trust me or decided to get payback for me ditching her. Fair enough. A point for her. I respected both her being cautious and trying to get even. In her place, I'd do the same thing. The honeycomb sat deep inside a gorge, a crack in the ground about 3 miles long and a quarter of a mile deep called the Honeycomb Gap. The gap pulled iron into itself, gathering it from junkyards and the abandoned Ford motor plant. The area around it lay in ruins, and climbing back and forth over the rubble with an injured leg and a bruised shoulder was all kinds of fun. If the magic had been up, I could have just called Turgon and had him scout the gap. The eagle would have spotted the cable in seconds. But with magic down, looking through Turgon's eyes wasn't an option. Turgon was an intelligent bird, but he was just a bird. Telling him to find the cable on his own was like asking Lassie if Timmy was stuck in a well. Words like cable had no meaning to an eagle. Instead, I picked my way through the debris and abandoned buildings for over an hour before I finally found it. A single phone line diving into the gap from a pole that rose at the top of a ruined three-story building. The structure's roof was gone, leaving the inside exposed, and the tall wooden pole had been anchored to the remains of the top floor with a mound of concrete. Climbing said pole with my hurt thigh proved to be about as fun as cuddling a feral cat. But after sliding down a couple of times and cursing in half a dozen languages, I finally cut the line, climbed down, and sat on the edge of the crumbling top floor, dangling my feet over the chasm. The gap stretched in front of me, plunging deep below, narrow in this spot, only a couple hundred feet across. A forest of curved metal spikes grew on its bottom, climbing up the sides. Piles of refuse, scrap metal mixed with trash, rose here and there between the skeletal husks of abandoned cars slowly melting into the gap. Fog slivered between the spikes and heaps of junk, curling in long tendrils, trying to reach up to the edge and the abandoned buildings rising on the other side. Far to the left, a bird glided above the gap. From here, it looked like a stork. Looks were deceiving. Honeycomb spawned Stymphalian birds with iron feathers that cut like razor blades. My leg hurt. Other parts of me hurt too, but the leg would need attention once I got home. Nick's pills had shaved a slight edge off the pain, but not enough to dull it. Sitting still felt like a sinful luxury. I had been sloppy. I should have anticipated Jasper's pounce from above. I hadn't because I'd been focused on saving the boy. Now I was paying for it. Douglas's face flashed before me. Worth it. When I was a teenager, I would have just shot Jasper. Back then, using a shotgun or a rifle wasn't a problem. I used to be a good shot. Not Andrea Medrano good, but decent enough. I could hit a target with a bow on horseback at full gallop. Now guns were no longer an option for me. All living beings generated magic. Some stored it, like shapeshifters, which enabled them to still transform during tech. Others, like me, emanated it. Over the years, I'd learned to transform these emanations into a cloak, hiding my power during magic. But without it, I was a miniature magic generator, and these emanations short-circuited tech in my immediate vicinity. Guns didn't work for me. Gasoline cars were a gamble. Sometimes I could drive one, sometimes it wouldn't start. Grandma warned me it would happen if I claimed my magic heritage. Kate used to have the same problem, and I used to snicker about it. Her magic short-circuited phones and guns. She'd try to make a call, hang up the phone in disgust, and stomp away, and then I'd pick it up and it worked perfectly. Now I had it worse than her. At least she could fire a gun. She couldn't hit water if she shot it from a boat in the middle of a lake, but the gun would discharge. I just got a smug click when I pulled the trigger. Still, trading proficiency in tech for one in magic was an easy choice at the time. I wanted to know where I came from and what my bloodline was capable of. I didn't regret it, but I kept paying for it. It was still the wiser option. Magic would win eventually. I sat quietly, enjoying not moving. The honeycombers seemed in no hurry to fix their phone. They probably wouldn't even notice for a few hours, until one of them picked up the phone and the line was dead. I needed a phone at my place. Phones worked for me about half of the time, and 50% was better than zero. I'd been in the city for over 24 hours, and so far made no progress. I killed a lesser Mavir, an insignificant victory. I found out that Pastor Haywood's murder was connected to some unknown magical artifact. I killed the King of Honeycomb. None of that brought me closer to stopping Moloch. It felt as if a huge doom clock hung over my head, counting off each second. I leaned back. No, I couldn't think like that. If I let myself run down that road, it would make me sloppy and desperate. I had to take my time, no matter how precious it was. A high-pitched shriek rolled through the gap. Yep, a Stymphalian bird. Derek and I used to come here for the feathers once or twice a year. They made good knives that never needed sharpening. We'd pack a lunch and make a day of it, combing the gap for the fallen feathers, then eating in one of the ruins just like this one. When we met, I was 13. He was 18. At that point, I'd only had one boyfriend in my short life, a slimy little weasel called Red who wanted to steal my magic. I thought he was amazing until he sold me out to the sea demons. Then Derek walked onto the scene like a blazing sun, and the sad puddle of scum that was Red evaporated. If I closed my eyes, I could picture Derek sitting next to me, long legs stretched over the edge, scarred face turned up to the sun, his eyes shut. An eerie feeling washed over me. The tiny hairs on the back of my neck rose. Something was watching me from across the gap. I scanned the ruins. Nothing. Whoever it was, they were well hidden. But they were there. The weight of the watcher's gaze pressed on me, like being sighted by a large predator ready to pounce. Every nerve in my body went on guard. I'd felt this before, when I'd arrived in the city. Something had watched me from the darkness as I rode across that bridge. Something dangerous and frightening. And here it was again. Was it tracking me? Why? I raised my hand, smiled, and waved. That's right. I know you're there. Come out to play. Nothing. The ruins lay still. It was still there, watching me. All my instincts warned me it was a threat, the kind of threat I didn't want to face with a busted leg. The simple animal part of me wanted to sit very still and hope that the thing that watched me would forget I was there. The crazy human part wanted to laugh in its face until the fear vanished in a flash of adrenaline. I made myself heave an exaggerated sigh, got up, and walked away, trying not to limp. I would come back to the gap later. Hopefully magic would be up. If my silent watcher decided to approach for a closer look, they would be in for a fun surprise. Magic flooded the world in a blink. The pain in my thigh flashed with heat and melted into a tolerable hurt. I shifted on the chunk of concrete and squinted at the setting sun. I had taken one of my Aunt Alara's herbal concoctions when I got home. The wave had activated its magic. If I managed not to strain the leg too much, I'd be almost at full power by tomorrow. After the Honeycomb Gap, I had gone to Jesus Junction and talked to the representatives of all three churches. None of them owned up to hiring Pastor Haywood or referring anyone to him in the past 6 months. Another dead end. Then I made my way to the municipal utility office, flashed my badge and a few $100 bills, and asked them to string a phone line to my house. The money gave them incentive, and the badge offered a convenient excuse to drop everything else and bump me to the front of the line as law enforcement. So they sent a technician out with me despite the end of the business day. To say he wasn't a fan of my house or the location would be an understatement, which was why I had to park myself outside between him and Unicorn Lane to officially guard him from that cursed place. The phone tech came striding up. He was short and broad, not fat, but solid, with a mop of curly dark hair and olive skin, and he spoke with a mild accent. He might have been Moroccan, but I wasn't sure and not rude enough to ask.
Well, I hooked it up, but we won't know if it works until magic falls again.
Story of my life. When I needed magic to fight oversized honeycombers, there was none to be had. But when I wanted a phone, suddenly I got all the magic ever. "Thanks," I told him. "I'll walk you out." He eyed Unicorn Lane. About 3 blocks down, a former skyscraper had sprung a small waterfall. A bluish liquid, shimmering with swirls of lavender, spilled over the top of the ruin and slowly slid down its side in a 3-foot-wide stream. It looked viscous.
"Yeah," the tech said. "I'll get my tools. If it doesn't work tomorrow, let us know."
The tech came back with his toolbox and we walked down Peachtree Circle, heading south toward civilization. My legs started hurting again. When I got home, I'd chanted into regeneration. Peachtree Circle ran into 15th Street. It used to be a 3-way intersection, and now it was more like a small roundabout, with the west end of 15th cut off by heaps of debris from fallen condominiums. The only way out was down the other end of 15th, southeast. A small shopping plaza had sprouted in the round intersection, only 2 shops, a pierogi stand manned by a smiling blonde man, and a convenience bus operated by an older, brown-skinned woman. The bus sold first aid supplies and necessities, salt, toiletries, bandages, and so on. The pierogi stall sold delicious pierogi. I had sampled them this morning on the way to St. Luke's. The intersection was now deserted, except for a lone beggar sitting on a ratty blanket by the debris. The tech waved at me and headed to his van, sitting by the pierogi stand. The beggar eyed me. Thin, old, with skin the color of dark chestnut creased by wrinkles, he hugged his knees on his blanket. His thin, greasy hair hung in long strands over his face. His shoes, beat-up old boots, waited next to him. Grime stained his bare feet. He held himself in that careful way people do when moving meant pain. He looked so alone. Wind fanned me, bringing with it a hint of stale urine and the thick scent of a human body that hadn't been washed for far too long. I walked up to the bus. The old lady was packing up for the day and pretended not to see me. I refused to move. Finally, she squinted at me. I pulled out $40 and put it on the counter. Men's socks and aspirin. She looked past me at the beggar, then at me, sighed, put 2 pairs of socks on the fold-out shelf, and added a small bottle of aspirin, 20 pills. "Thanks." I took myself to the pierogi stall, bought the mushroom flavor, less chance of rat meat that way, and took it and my bus purchases over to the beggar. He shied away from me, scrambling backward. I left the stuff and $20 on the edge of his blanket and walked away. By the time I got home, less than a mile away, my leg was in full protest mode. I walked into the house, locked the door behind me, and headed into my sanctuary. I reached the door and stopped. Someone was inside. I didn't hear anyone. I didn't see anyone, but I knew with absolute certainty that someone had broken into my home. I walked through the doorway, shut the door behind me, and slid the heavy bar in place, trapping the intruder inside with me. Quiet. Water gurgled in the stream bed. Plants spread their leaves, eager for the light. I cracked my knuckles. A dark shape lunged at me from the left, flying through the air as if he had wings. I sidestepped, gripping the intruder by the arm, and flipped him in midair, using my entire weight to drive him down. His back slapped the limestone. He flipped, legs over shoulders, bounced up like he was made of rubber, and crouched 10 feet away, a big grin on his face. "Damn it, Conlon. You need to work on your pouncing." Gray eyes laughed at me. "You need to work on your hearing. I stood 5 feet behind you for a whole minute before I walked into your house. You never turned around." So he'd snuck in before the magic hit. Explained how he got past my wards. "Remind me, what did I say about not blowing my cover?" He shrugged. "Who's here to see us? I don't see anybody." He made a show of looking through the plants. "Are you hiding witnesses in your pretty shrubs?" The problem with Conlon was that he had his father's unshakable confidence and his mother's mouth. He was also Roland's grandson. He'd spoken in complete sentences when he was 18 months old, and he cracked complex incantations like they were sunflower seeds when he was 5. Math was child's play. Engineering was a fun amusement. Chemistry was a hobby, and he took none of it seriously. His eyes shone. "Do you have food?" And he was a 9-year-old were-lion. "Maybe." I headed to my fridge. Tamira Miller had stocked it to my specifications. Let's see. What could I make that would be fast and filling? Ham, chicken, venison? "Yes. Normally, I charge 1 hug per meal, but for you, it's free." I wasn't a fan of forcing hugs on children. If he wanted to give me a hug, he knew I would welcome one. He pretended to sigh, came over, and hugged me. He did it very carefully, using a fraction of his strength, aware that he was hugging a human. I'd finally seen my brother in person after 8 long years. "Hey," I told him. He grinned at me and broke free. I pulled out a chunk of salted smoked ham, wild mushrooms, 4 slices of bacon, and some cheddar and mozzarella, got a cutting board and my cleaver, and stocked the fire in the stove. Conlon settled into a chair by the kitchen table. "You really aren't glad to see me?" "Of course I'm glad to see you. But now your scent is everywhere, and Ascanio knows where I live." Conlon wrinkled his face, showing me a hint of a fang. I set the pan onto the fire, tossed bacon into it, and started dicing ham into bite-sized chunks. Conlon spun around on his chair, leaned to the side until he was nearly horizontal, and plucked a metal sphere from the nearest pedestal. It was about the size of a basketball, a ball of delicate metal lace and gears. I had placed 6 of them around the sanctuary. Conlon tossed it up over his head, sending a spark of magic through it. The sphere unfolded into a monstrous metal spider above his head, razor mandibles out, metal claws poised for a kill. For a fraction of a second, it hovered above him, looking ready to devour his head. Then the tiny drop of magic powering it ran out, and it fell, rolling back into a ball. Conlon caught it with his other hand. The control required to achieve this would make the sages back at New Shinar giddy with joy. Conlon spun the sphere in his fingers and tossed it back up. Sphere, spider, sphere, spider, sphere. I finished with the ham, flipped the bacon, and moved on to slicing the mushrooms. "What's the deal with you and Ascanio?"
"I don't like him."
I cut the cheese into thin slices.
"Did he do something?"
Conlon shrugged.
"That's not important."
"Okay, I'll bite. What is important?" I took the bacon out, drained most of the fat into a jar, and tossed mushrooms and ham into the pan.
"I want to help."
"Help with what?"
"Help with the secret thing that you talk to Grandfather about when I'm not there. The secret thing that makes you stay here and prevents you from coming home."
"Ah, that secret thing." I took out 6 eggs, cracked them into the pan, and moved them back and forth with my spatula. Conlon, like his dad, couldn't stand runny eggs. He'd complained about them before when discussing school meals. And, like his dad and most shapeshifters, his tolerance for heat in his food was almost non-existent. If I'd been cooking for me, I would have been throwing jalapenos into the pan. I salted the scramble and reached for the cheese. My cutting board wasn't there. Conlon sat on the table, holding the cutting board with the neat stack of cheese slices out of my reach.
"Really? You're avoiding the answer.
Give me the cheese and we'll talk about it." He handed the cheese over. I tossed it onto the eggs, stirred it a bit, and took the pan off the fire. He watched me. I took a fork out of the drawer, added a big plate, slid the eggs and melted cheese onto it, and pushed it toward him. He tried it.
"Tastes like Mom's."
"Well, of course. Who do you think taught me to cook?"
"Do you remember when I was 7 and I had a problem with the druid clique at school?"
"What about it?" "Druids had a lot of magic that directly affected animals." He had been 7, and the group of kids that tried to torment him were twice his age. He'd refused to tell Kate or Curran about it, and if he'd resorted to violence, he would have been expelled.
You remember what you said to me? You said, "You have to tell me these things. I'm your sister." And the next day, when we went on a lunch break, Roman was waiting for me in the yard in his black and silver robe. He had his staff with the bird head that screeched at people, and when I got near, it started purring. He gave me a big hug and announced he'd brought me pierogi his mother had specially made for me. We had lunch and talked about family and what to get people for Koliata and Christmas. Never had a problem after that.
Roman was a black volve, a Slavic pagan priest. He served Chernobog, the god of decay, war, and darkness. All neo-pagans were taught from an early age about other neo-pagans, and Roman was officially listed in their registry under the heading of Do Not Fuck With. His mother, Evdokia, was one of the witches of the Witch Oracle. I took lessons from her when I was young, which was how Sienna and I became friends. Calling Roman for a minor favor was no trouble. The priest of the god of all evil loved helping people. It was his chance to shine, and he made the most of it. Kate had done something similar for me when I was a teenager. Your point? He raised his head from the food. There was barely half left on his plate.
You have to tell me these things. I am your brother.
Aw. But he was only 9. The Mavarim were dangerous as hell. Conlon leaned forward, his gaze unblinking and direct.
I'm not a baby.
It's like he was telepathic sometimes. You're not a baby, but you often act like one. You don't like to study, you don't apply yourself, and you squeak by doing the bare minimum to keep Grandfather from losing his temper. Conlon raised his hand. Claws burst from his flesh. The hand stretched, fingers elongating into monstrous digits. Coal black fur sheathed the new hand. He sliced at his forearm. Thin threads of blood stretched from his wounds, wound about his hand and snapped into a gauntlet. Someone had been practicing. Let me see the range of motion. He moved his fingers, bending them toward his palm, pinky to thumb. Blood-armored claws cut through the air. The hair on the back of my neck rose. Making blood weapons and armor was one of the 2 most important skills to the Shannar bloodline. Dealing with the Shar, an irresistible urge to claim land and defend it from all threats, was the other. Blood armor had its limits, and blood weapons broke after a few hours of use, their magic exhausted. But while they lasted, they made you practically invulnerable. A blood blade cut through solid steel like it was nothing. It was a skill that would have been out of my reach if it wasn't for Kate. Years ago, I was bitten by a shapeshifter and my body rebelled against me. I would have gone loop, but the pack's chief physician, Dr. Doolittle, had sedated me, delaying the inevitable to allow Kate and Curran to come to terms with it. I was going to be put down. In a last-ditch effort to save me, Kate pulled the blood out of my body with magic and washed it with hers, purging the like V from me. Her blood coursed through me, and it gave me the powers of her bloodline. Even after my transformation forever altered me, I had retained the power of blood magic. After Era and I had awakened her people, Era named me her formal heir. Some of the advisors raised concerns about whether or not I was suitable. I walked into the session of the council, dumped a gallon of vampire blood at my feet, cut my arm, and clothed myself in blood armor. Nobody ever questioned my right to rule again. Conlon rotated his wrist. The gauntlet fit him like second skin. The construction was perfect. A year ago, he could only coat his claws. It must have taken him months of intense work. I wondered why he spent so much time with Grandfather. Every time I popped in, he was there.
I've applied myself, my brother said. I want in.
He was looking at me with that single-minded determination I often saw on Kate's face. Conlon had made up his mind. He would find out what was going on.
My choices had shrunk to two options: tell him myself and control the narrative, or let him figure it out on his own and kiss the chances of reining him in goodbye. I'm trusting you with something important. I know. One careless word, and we'll end up with the kind of disaster nobody can fix. I understand. What do you know? If you go home, Mom dies. Grandfather? He nodded. He told me 8 months ago. I haven't told anyone. I understand the gravity of the situation. Let me help. It's imperative that your parents don't know. I understand. You must learn everything you can about Moloch. Who is he? The enemy. An ancient god has been reborn as an avatar. The witch oracle foretold that in the future he will kill your mother. We've been trying to alter that future, but so far we've failed. If your mother finds out about the prophecy, she will die. He sat very still. Fear flickered in his gray eyes. That's how I reacted the first time the meaning of the prophecy had really sank in. The eye you took, did it belong to Moloch? He asked. Yes. Is that why you look different? Yes. I pulled an unmarked book off the shelf and put it in front of him. He opened it and stared at the pages lined with my handwriting and illustrations of sigils. This is everything I know about Moloch right now. This book doesn't leave this house. Read it here, commit it to memory. Once you're done, you must go to Grandfather and get as many details about Moloch as you can. Moloch attempted to invade Shinar in the past. Grandfather can tell you more. I need you to figure out what to watch out for. I need you to guard your mother. If you spot any signs of Moloch or his shithead priests, you must tell me immediately. Do everything you can to keep Kate and them from interacting. The distant cry of an eagle echoed through my mind. Turgon. I let the eagle's sight unfold in my mind. Nick's house came into focus, like a vision woven in a net of glowing threads. Turgon turned his head. A large lupine shape was coming toward us, running at full speed down the dark street. What in the world? The wolf stopped by Nick's front door. It was massive, bigger than any wild wolf I'd seen that wasn't dire. A shapeshifter. Their beast forms ran larger than their animal counterparts. The wolf sat on its haunches and gently scratched the door. A moment, and the door swung open. The wolf's body surged up, a controlled whirlwind of flesh and bone, and a nude woman rose on Nick's doorstep, long blonde hair falling down to her waist. The woman threw her arms around Nick. The eagle caught a glimpse of her face, and I almost fell out of my chair. What? He scooped her up, carried her inside, and kicked the door closed behind him. Nicholas Feldman, the Knight Protector of Atlanta's Chapter of the Order, the paragon of knightly virtue, was having a torrid affair with Desandra Krall, the alpha of Clan Wolf. I got the hell out of the chair. This I had to see. Earth to Julie, Colin said. I have to go. I'll come with. Not this time. But there is something you can do for me tonight. Read the book first, then go to Schreiker Boulevard on the edge of the Honeycomb Gap. One of the ruins has a wooden pole with a phone line going from it. I cut it this afternoon. If they repaired it, cut it again. Don't let yourself be seen. My brother smiled. Done. I told him my phone number. Don't write it down anywhere. Call me tomorrow when tech hits and tell me how it went. I was almost to the sanctuary doorway when he called out, Julie? Yes? Do you blame Mom for that time? I stopped and turned around. When Kate washed my blood with hers, she created a magic bond between us. That bond gave her the ability to suppress my will. For the next few years, I was magically tethered to Kate. I was aware of her at all times. I couldn't pinpoint her exact location, but I knew in which direction to go to find her from miles away.
I sensed when she was hurt, and if she gave me a direct order, I was compelled to obey. She had only given me that kind of order once, and for the best of reasons. The shock of having my will crushed haunted me for years. It was the deepest violation of me I'd ever experienced. The bond was no more. Kate's death had severed it. She had died for mere seconds, but it set me free. The freedom was agony. The severed bond left behind a gaping raw wound that burned and gnawed on my soul. It took me a long time to heal. My Uncle Hugh and I had that in common. He too had been once bound to Grandfather. If it hadn't been for him, I would have suffered more. I'd rather die than experience that again. It wasn't just an empty turn of phrase. If anyone ever attempted to bind me again, I'd slit my own throat. Conlin was waiting for an answer. I don't blame her. She was trying to save my life. I love Kate very much, Conlin. She, Curran, you, and Grandmother, you are the people I treasure most. You are my family. In this wide world, with all its knowledge, riches, and pleasures, only the people you love matter most. Read the book. Call me tomorrow. I walked out. The full moon shone in the night sky like a coin of white gold, sliding in and out of ragged clouds. I sat on Tulip's back, in the shadow of a large dogwood on the edge of what used to be West End Park. Decades ago, the trees inside the park had rioted, fed by magic. They grew at a shocking rate, spreading their branches, stretching their roots until the park became a forest. Across from me, on the other side of Lucille Avenue, a solid two-story building rose in the middle of a lot, built like a fortress, with thick stone walls and windows shielded by steel and silver grates. It sat alone, the nearest neighbor 500 yards away. Nick liked his privacy. A lone oak spread thick branches near the house. Technically, it presented a security issue since someone could hide in its branches, like Turgon was doing right now. But Nick clearly didn't care. Anything that could climb that oak could likely climb the building, and the trees shaded the house. In a time when air conditioning was an unbelievable luxury, a shady spot was worth its weight in gold. It took me about 30 minutes to get here through the deserted streets, and I had disconnected from Turgon for most of it. Eavesdropping on Nick and Desandra's private time was close to dead last on the list of things I wanted to do. The night breeze fanned my face. So nice after the heat of the day. The city around me lay empty. Anyone with a crumb of sense hid indoors at night, behind thick walls and sturdy doors. Why Desandra? I wouldn't have imagined those two being together in a million years. Nick was a rock in a storm, calm, steady, unmovable, never losing his temper until the very end. His was a cold kind of crazy. Desandra was a hot whirlwind, funny, unpredictable, and often wildly inappropriate. She said things that made Buddhas blush. She was also deadly. Years ago, Kate and Curran went to the Mediterranean with some heavy hitters from the pack to get Panacea, an herbal remedy that reduces the occurrence of lupism. They came back with Christopher, who was now Barabbas' husband, along with Desandra and her twin newborn sons. She made her first kill on U.S. soil 2 days after she joined the pack, and within a year clawed her way to becoming the wolf alpha. Was she using him? I couldn't imagine what for. Well, I could imagine, but I didn't want to. If I delayed any longer, they might fall asleep. I shut my eyes and gingerly tried to listen through Turgon's ears. "Haywood murder," Nick said. "Oh, good, good, good. Talking. Talking was great. Good people don't last, but assholes live forever," Desandra murmured. I sank into the glowing web of Turgon's sight and saw them through the window. They were lying in bed, Desandra's head resting on Nick's arm, her golden hair spilling over the pillow in a tangled curtain.
Where was Decimir last Thursday night? Nick asked.
Where he usually is, home.
Are you sure? Desandre returned, leaning her head on her bent elbow so she could look at him.
Do you think my son murdered Haywood? Her tone wasn't hostile, just softly chiding.
The killer flew in through the skylight, ripped the body to shreds with its claws, then went back out through the skylight. It was a cat kill.
Desandre sighed.
He's going through puberty, Nick said.
Yes, between him and Maladin, I knock before I open any door in the house. Every sock is a possible landmine. I make them do their own laundry. Was there something wrong with Decimir? Desandre had had a weird pregnancy. Her two sons were born at the same time but had different fathers. Maladin was a wolf, and Decimir was a lynx. I'd babysat both when they were toddlers a dozen times. They were normal shapeshifter babies. Their magic was identical Hunter Green. Why would Nick think that Decimir could fly? Weirder and weirder.
You see him every weekend, Desandre said. Why don't you ask him?
Because I don't want him to think I suspect him.
But you do.
No, I don't. But other people might, and if it ever comes up, I want to have all my facts ready. If I have to defend him, I need to be able to honestly say where he was at the time of the murder. If you tell me he was home, I believe you. I just need you to be sure we can prove it.
Desandre sighed again. Was it Eaton? Haywood's body?
They took his heart, but no.
Well, there's your answer. We both know what my son is. He also knows what he is. We raised him well. He's a smart kid. He has no interest in power or turning into a monster. He spent Thursday at home doing what he usually does, which is reading old comic books and listening to music. There are half a dozen people besides me and Maladin who can confirm this.
Good.
Decimir had nothing to do with it. No matter what he turned into, his primary magic was that of a shapeshifter. Like V left a magic trail a mile long, and it colored all other magic a person might have. Years ago, before I left, Curran fed on divine beasts to gain more power and save Kate from death. He'd been a hair away from true divinity, and his magic was still green. The creature that killed Pastor Haywood was golden silver.
I know mothers don't know everything, but I don't see him doing this. He is a 13-year-old boy. Can you picture him smashing through a skylight, ripping apart a holy man he'd never met, and digging out his heart?
No, Nick said. Even if he turned, there are easier targets. He could hunt homeless in the Warren, and nobody would know for years.
Desandre traced his jaw with her fingertips. Then why did you ask?
Ferrara is sniffing around this case.
Desandre collapsed onto a pillow, her arms in the air.
Of course he is. Do you think he knows about Decimir?
If he does, Andrea or Raphael told him. Kate would never. Neither would Doolittle or the Bears. She was right. Besides Curran, I was the closest person to Kate, and I had no idea what the hell they were talking about. This was clearly pack business, and at least a dozen people knew, but somehow everyone who came back from that trip managed to keep this secret. Curiosity was killing me.
Does Jim know? Nick asked.
I imagine he does. A low snarl reverberated in Desandra's throat. He was the chief of security at the time.
Curran would have told him. So this could be coming from the top or from the Buddhas.
Jim and I have never had a problem. We have our disagreements, but he isn't petty. If he suspected something, he would have given it to the rats. Clan Rat ran the pact security. You know Jim, Desandre continued. He does everything by the book, with a paper trail and receipts. No, this is coming from the Buddhas.
Ascanio could be acting on his own. He's ambitious, Nick mused. Desandre grimaced.
There's the understatement of the year. If Decimir was responsible and Ascanio found the proof, would he try blackmail, or would he bring it to Jim and try to remove you? A golden sheen rolled over Desandra's irises. Her hand flexed on the pillow as if it had claws. I don't know exactly what his game is, but I'll find out. A chill dashed down my spine. Nope, she hadn't mellowed. Not even a bit. Ascanio wasn't stupid. Why would he screw with her? Nick leaned to the side, pulled a piece of paper out of something I couldn't see, and held it out to Desandra.
Smell this.
She grinned. Oh, baby, such inventive come-ons you have. Nick rolled his eyes. Desandra plucked the paper from his fingers and sniffed it. Why am I smelling this?
A woman showed up at my office. This is a form she filled out. She has a badge that dictates that I assist her in every way possible.
Kinky. How do I get one of those?
You have to render a great service to the order.
Desandra grinned and smelled the paper again. Oh, I've done that many, many times. Nick smiled. Oh, my gods.
Have you smelled this scent before?
Desandra shook her head. No, I would remember. Why?
Nick frowned. There's something familiar about her. I can't put my finger on it, but...
Keep your finger and everything else away from her.
Desandra's eyes flashed again. She toyed with the paper. Is she pretty?
Pretty is the wrong word.
Desandra's voice dropped into dangerous territory. What is the right word?
Regal.
Nick grimaced and held out his hand.
I need the paper back.
No. Desandra held the paper out of his reach and sniffed it again. I like smelling it. My magic gave me an affinity to horses, birds of prey, and wolves. They liked my scent.
Seriously?
Nick reached for the paper. You can't have it. Mine. Desandra waved the paper and stopped abruptly, her eyes looking straight at me like two shiny moons. Honey, where is your crossbow?
By the bed. Why?
There is an eagle in your tree.
So?
I grew up in the Carpathian Mountains. We had many eagles. They sleep at night.
Busted. I sent a mental push to Turgon. Go.
The eagle took off. I tossed a handful of wolfsbane into the air, spun Tulip around, and urged her into a canter. She flew through the night-soaked streets like a ghost. Wind tugged at my hair. Even if Desandra chased me, she'd have a hard time catching up, and the wolfsbane would leave her nose blind for a couple of hours. Ahead, Lucille Avenue dead-ended into Abernathy Boulevard. We made a right and headed northwest. An eerie howl floated on the night wind. The hair on the back of my neck stood on end, an instinctual reaction coded in my genes from when humans were food and feared being eaten. It had come from the left. If Desandra had chased me and howled, it would have come from the right or behind us. Were there wolves guarding her? She could have brought a team with her. Had I blundered into a trap? I sent my magic out in a pulse. It splayed out, searching, collided with bodies, and I felt wolves running fast through the wrecked houses on my right. One, two, a second group on the left, gliding through the overgrown wood that used to be Westview Cemetery. Three more, all larger than a wild wolf had a right to be. Shit. Another howl rose, a vicious song of hunt, a promise of sharp fangs and a swift death. A second howl answered. The pack was closing in. Tulip neighed, more outrage than fear, and broke into a gallop. We thundered up the deserted street past the husks of abandoned homes. The wolves sang again. Ice rolled down my spine. This wasn't a pretend chase. I was being hunted. A new presence came in from the right, moving fast on the edge of my magic. It lashed my senses like a knife, emanating power.
Not to Sandra. Something else. Something savage. Something more. Moving way too fast. Tulip screamed in alarm. We rounded the curve. Ahead, something blocked the road. The moon peeked through the clouds. An overturned semi, flanked by a bunch of smashed cars. Wolves burst from the woods behind me. Forest on the left, semi in front. Turning right toward East I-20 was my only option. I swung Tulip onto MLK Drive. The overpass in front of me had crumbled. A hill of debris blocked the road. A dead end. They'd ran me to ground. I let the reins go slack so Tulip could stop on her own. She made a wide arc by the rubble, slowing, and I turned her toward the road and the cemetery on the other side, our backs to the overpass. I was done running. No more howling. It was quiet now. The only sound was Tulip breathing hard. Shadows congealed from the gloom between the trees on the other side. Slowly, paw over paw, the wolves padded out into the open. Three from the woods, two from the right, coming from Abernathy. Two gray Eurasians, one white Arctic, and the other two gray sprinkled with cinnamon, timbers. Every single one was over 200 pounds. Five pairs of glowing eyes stared at me. Tulip bared her teeth. The odds weren't in my favor. With the magic up, I could take them, but then the pack would come after me in force. A huge shape leaped from the roof of a brick building on the left and landed in front of the pack. Magic screamed a warning in my head. The gray monster, bigger than any lupine shapeshifter I had ever seen, raised his head. He was almost as big as Curran, and Curran was a fucking prehistoric lion. Two golden eyes focused on me, their gaze pinning me in place. Suddenly, it was hard to breathe. My body locked up, convinced that I was prey. The alpha stare. He dared. I stared right back. Holding his gaze was like trying to lift a car. The moon tore through the clouds, spilling pale light onto the intersection. It slid over the giant wolf's fur, setting it aglow. He wasn't gray. He was silver. Unnaturally silver. I blinked, bringing my magic vision up. A faint mint green rippled over his coat. Fuck. The wolf took a step forward, bathed in moonlight. My hands went cold. A bitter metallic taste coated my tongue. I blinked the magic colors away and reached for my bow, attached to Tulip's saddle. Step. Another. I raised my bow. Everything came into crystal clear focus. My breathing was deep and even. The world shrank down to three things: the wolf, my bow, and the distance between us. A third step. I plucked an arrow from the quiver. His black lips stretched, showing me a forest of fangs. Keep smiling. You'll look really funny with an arrow sticking out of your mouth. His silver fur tore. In an instant, bone melted like wax, reshaping itself. Muscles stretched, snapping over the new frame. And human skin sheathed the new form. A man with golden eyes stared at me. Tall, broad-shouldered, corded with muscle. The moonlight played over his face, highlighting the network of thin scars. Derek. My heart stopped. It couldn't have, because I would have died, but it felt like it had. His eyes were ice cold. He looked at me as if this was his land and I'd trespassed. Derek opened his mouth. I had to run. Now, before I heard his voice. I sent a mental scream to Tulip. Go! The magic command whipped Tulip into motion. She reared, pawing the air. The faint outline of a horn shimmered on her forehead. Tulip spun, surged toward the rubble, leaped, landing on the broken concrete like a gazelle, and dashed over the fallen overpass. For a moment, we went airborne,
and then we were galloping down the road at a breakneck speed into the night.
9. I paced back and forth inside my sanctuary. Why did I run? I'd been in battles that had lasted days. I had dived into Eagle's Nest Sink, a cave so dangerous, it had a sign with a grim reaper on it and a warning, "There is nothing in this cave worth dying for," because I had to talk to a mermaid. I visited my grandfather every couple of weeks, for crying out loud. And the moment Derek opened his mouth, I turned tail and ran. All the fights I'd been in, all the torture I'd braved, all the magic I'd learned, and that's what undid me. Meeting the guy who used to be the center of my universe until I turned 18. Stupid. So stupid. Was I 13 again? What the hell had happened? He hadn't recognized me. The look he gave me was so cold. It hurt. Some fragile part of me must have been convinced that the moment he saw me, he would magically know who I was. But he didn't. It wasn't him. It was me. I made myself run away. I thought I'd buried that crush. I was no longer an adolescent who kept hoping Derek would realize I was growing up and fall in love with me. I didn't say goodbye to him before I left because I was too chicken to chance it. If he'd asked me to stay, I might not have gone through with it. And if he hadn't, it would have crushed me. None of that was his fault. He had to know how I felt. He never took advantage of it. He never even gave me a hint that he was waiting for me. In all the time I was gone, he hadn't even tried to find me. After that initial phone call, I called home every week when I could. Kate and Curran knew where I was. If Derek wanted to see me, all he had to do was ask them. For the first couple of years, I had held on to a fragile hope that one day he would just show up unannounced. But he never had. And then Kate told me he left Atlanta. I waited. I was so sure he would make his way to me in California. He hadn't. I gave up. It hurt too much, so I let it go. Atlanta had stirred up memories, and I had thought of him more than once in the last couple of days. But prior to that, I made myself abandon him. Sa akin tunar irani es. His shadow didn't darken my mind. 8 years had passed. Everything about me had changed. But I was still in love with Derek Gaunt. How was this possible? I sat on a plush azure divan. In front of me, a bronze statue shimmered softly with reflected light, a winged serpent winding around a slender pole, her swan-like wings spread wide as if she were about to take flight above the white gardenia blossoms and burgundy star-shaped hoyas dripping from their trellises, at once delicate and ferocious. One of Era's artists had created this statue and offered it to me as tribute. That's how she'd seen me, the princess of this new age, always ready to spill blood in defense of the new kingdom's people, beautiful and deadly. Thank you for the reminder, Gometti. I was no longer Julie. These feelings were a ghostly echo from someone else, and that girl was gone. Derek didn't know the new me. There was no connection between us. I didn't know the new him either. The Derek I knew had been born into a religious household deep in the mountains of Appalachia, where families were money poor but land rich. They guarded their land and their independence with "trespassers will be shot" signs, and meant it. When Derek was 14, his father caught Like V at a tent revival. He went loop fast, drowning in the brew of runaway hormones. Loopism had no cure. It turned shapeshifters into psychotic, sadistic spree killers. Derek's father was no exception. Every repressed urge, every dark desire forbidden by religion and law, bubbled up to the surface and exploded. The neighbors and authorities minded their own business. Nobody had helped. Derek's mother and sisters became his father's hostages and slaves.
His mother caught the virus from his father and killed herself, leaving Derek, his brother, and his five sisters alone with a loop. The nightmare lasted almost 2 years. Everyone became infected within months. They tried to fight their father, but loops were freakishly strong. Two of Derek's siblings died from starvation, chained by their father in the basement. Three of his sisters died from their injuries. One went loop and turned on her brothers and sisters, reveling in their father's demented cruelty. The day Derek found the half-eaten body of his youngest sister, he couldn't take it anymore. The local authorities finally took notice when a column of smoke rose from the top of the mountain and called in the pack. When Curran arrived with a group of shapeshifters, they found Derek sitting by the burned-out husk of his house, his father's blood on his hands. He'd finally stopped the nightmare, but it was too late for everyone else. Derek didn't resist. He made no effort to explain what happened. He didn't speak at all. He'd ripped his father apart, and that's all he cared about. Jim, the current Beast Lord, thought Derek would go loop and wanted to kill him. Curran forbade it. He took Derek with him to the pack and slowly coaxed him back to life. That was my Derek, and he held himself in a steel grip. Everything that influenced shapeshifters affected him stronger than normal. The moon made him half crazy. When he locked onto a scent, nothing else mattered. And when he fought, Derek had a hard time sparring. He was worried that if he let go of his control by a hair, he would fall off the same cliff his father had. He never felt comfortable around other shapeshifters. Their presence made his struggle for control worse. But he was fanatically loyal to Curran and Kate. He stayed in the pack for their sake, and when Curran stepped down, Derek was right behind him. He didn't hesitate for a second. After the separation from the pack, Derek fully embraced his lone wolf of Atlantis status. He worked for Cutting Edge, but he seemed most content when he was working on his own. Old Derek was a loner. The new Derek had a pack. He had landed with his back to them, and they had positioned themselves to protect him. I had no doubt that if he growled a command, they would have tried to tear me apart. That was his pack, not Desandra's, not a pack crew. His. Old Derek was gray. Large, by shapeshifter standards, but still within normal range for a lupine shapeshifter. The new Derek was silver, bright uniform silver, without any black or brown, and he was huge. I'd never seen a werewolf that large before. Old Derek emanated strong hunter green, right in line with the rest of the pack. The new Derek left a trail of mint green magic. Old Derek's eyes glowed amber. The man I saw tonight had eyes that shone with gold. And it wasn't just the shine. It was the way he looked at me. He'd stared at me as if I had intruded into his territory and he had the right to punish me. He'd given me the alpha stare. You couldn't buy one of those. You couldn't steal or borrow it. You could learn to imitate it, but most natural leaders were born with it. It was one of the most effective means of control for a pack leader. Curran had raised it to the level of art, and Conlin was doing his best to catch up. In all of our years together, I had never seen Derek give someone the alpha stare. He focused on them, and he had what I used to call his death glare, but it wasn't an alpha stare. What the hell had happened? It was Derek. The scars were unmistakable. Perhaps that was all that was left of the Derek I used to know. Ascanio must have realized Derek was back in the city. That time when he had tried to take the cookie from me, a shapeshifter, one of his people, had run up and reported that she saw him, and then she waved her hand in front of her face. She must have been indicating the scars. Besides our family and the Medranos, Derek would be just about the only person for whom Ascanio would drop everything and go chasing into the night. The rivalry between them started the day Ascanio tried to put his hands on me, and Derek had shown him the error of his ways. It never got better,
only worse. Derek had returned to Atlanta, and now he and Ascanio both were somehow tangled up in Pastor Haywood's murder. Why had he left in the first place? Something had occurred. Some seismic shift must have taken place for him to abandon Kate and Curran and disappear. Maybe it wasn't Derek at all. Maybe something was just wearing his body. The thought brought me up short. If something dared to take his body, I would kill it. Magic flashed in my mind. Someone had just crossed my outer ward. I jumped off the divan, picked up my spear, and marched to the front door. It couldn't be him. I had used Wolfsbane, and then Tulip and I swam through Lake Adair for half a mile, dodging water snakes and snapping turtles living on the drowned trees left over from when the lake had been Adair Park. It would take him and his people ages to find my scent, if they ever did. Someone knocked on my door. I flung it open. Knight Stella Davis took a step back. "Easy now. I just came to borrow a cup of sugar." The tension went out of me. "White or brown?" "I don't know. I don't really bake." Stella looked over my shoulder. "That's a textbook shithole you're living in. I admire your commitment, but just so you know, we don't take a vow of poverty in the order. You can live somewhere nice, with furniture that hasn't been gnawed on." "Ha, ha. It's after midnight. Did you need something, or did you just come over to insult my house?" Stella narrowed her eyes. "Aren't you curious how I found you?" "Let me guess. Someone from the city called you about the phone service?" A little of the excitement went out of her. "Yep. Funny thing, when you wave around an order badge and a wad of cash, people still want to check you out and see if you're legit. Great job staying off the grid. You should teach covert work at the academy."
"Would that be before or after your class on surveillance, with an emphasis on how to lose a suspect on your home turf?" "That really pissed you off, didn't it?"
"Yes. Yes, it did. But now I found you."
"Congratulations. You're the best that's ever been."
Stella grinned. "Thank you." She raised a piece of paper and waved it at me. "Fine." I made my tone flat and disinterested.
"What's that?"
"This is a murder. I think it's connected to yours." I opened the ward. "Come in." "Is it safe? Will the germs get me?"
"Poverty isn't contagious. You'll be fine."
Stella entered and followed me to the kitchen. "Beer? Coffee? Tea?" "From this kitchen? No thanks." She passed me the paper. I read it. A name and an address. "Alicia Walton,